from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Contemporary fiction and 19th century Southern American literature, this week on Soundings. First, a conversation with Elizabeth Spencer about her new collection of short stories. Following that, a discussion with Mary Ann Wimsatt about her study of the 19th century Southern American writer William Gilmore Sims. Elizabeth Spencer teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's the author of 8 novels, including The Light in the Piazza. Speaking about the title story in her new collection, Jack of Diamonds, here is Elizabeth Spencer.
It came up out of one thing about Central Park, where the story starts, an apartment up above Central Park. I used to admire those settings when I came to New York, and somebody once suggested to me at a luncheon when I said I didn't have a plot in mind for a story or novel. This was an editor asking me. She said, you handle situations so well of younger people. Or have you ever thought about what a young person might feel if their parents were involved in the theatrical world or the show business world? This was something that was on her mind. This germinated, I suppose, for years without my knowing about it, but
Where did this character of Nat Jennings, is that his last
Nat
name?
Jennings.
Who is this theatrical, he's not a producer, he's involved in musical
dance,
productions.
Dance and musical productions, yeah. Something he got into in college.
And he's the Jack of Diamonds.
He's the man
with the face that, we see it, but we don't see it. Their surface is there.
You turn the card, yeah. And there's the same face, you think.
Where did he come from, Elizabeth Spencer?
He just came walking in. I don't know where my characters come from sometimes.
Uh-huh. Let me look at you wide-eyed, Elizabeth Spencer, and say, are these people real to you?
They're very real to me.
Do you know them the way you know somebody that you would see week in, week out at the grocery store, or even people that you know more, that you see more frequently than that? Do you imagine them? Do you talk to them? Do they talk to you? Tell me about that.
They don't talk to me. They talk to each other.
Uh-huh.
I'm the invader in their lives, though they don't know it. So there have been a lot of amusing things done on this, you know. Oh, there's Pirandello's play of 6 characters looking for an author.
Right.
And they are various.
Do you have this chain of people behind you following you around?
I think I have been haunted at times by characters.
Another one of your titles, Elizabeth Spencer, in Jack of Diamonds, is The Business Venture. It's a story about, we have a woman narrator, a female narrator, who's talking about a friend of hers who, what is this, in the late 60s, early 70s?
This is 1976. It's pinpointed in one speech in the stories, but it could be the 60s, of course.
And we have two people, a white woman and a black man, mm-hmm. trying to get a dry cleaning business going. And the story deals with the concentric circles that flow out from this business venture. Where did that story come from?
That came from a lot of directions, too. I was driving through a small town in South Mississippi, and there was I imagined I saw a Victorian house with a wing at the side and a sign up for some business that was going on in that wing, but I didn't know what it was. I was, a lot of times when I'm driving around the car alone, I think of stores. That stuck with me, the sight of that house just at the turn of the road in this little town, and being one of the biggest houses of a Victorian sort rather than a classical sort in that town. I thought, well, what kind of business would be run at? I'm not quite sure that happened. I remember the house, but I don't know whether I imagined the business or not. And how it turned into a dry cleaning business is odd, too, because there was a black man at home in my little hometown of Carrollton that my mother was always saying, he's the best dry cleaner I've ever had. He used his GI mustering out pay.
Mm-hmm.
To study dry cleaning, and she would say, now, isn't that a useful thing to do, you know, that he's just wonderful at that. So this was something I didn't forget.
You replicated that in this character, in the story.
Yeah, but all the business of his working for a white woman who might have lived in that house I saw in South Mississippi, not in Carrollton, which is in North Mississippi, grew out of the idea of how I done this before. How women who are left coping in those big houses when the money goes, how do they make a living? You know, what is their financial alternative?
Well, this leads to
this one thing led to another. It just, you know, it picks up as it goes along and gathers up many.
It leads me to ask you, Elizabeth Spencer, you talk about money. We've been talking about a white woman, a black man starting a business in this story, the business venture. Is this story about love and sex? Is it about business? Is it about race relations? Help me to nail that one down. Or is it important to you that you get it nailed down?
People say academically you have to say what a story is about, don't they?
Well, you've got a title to begin with.
The story is about the story.
Sure.
I don't know. I think it really is about a business venture, but somebody was teasing me in New York at a dinner party we went to after one of the meetings in New York. He turned to me out of nowhere and he said, "Did they or didn't they, Elizabeth?" And we weren't talking about the business venture at all. I knew at once what he meant.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "That's what keeps you reading."
Uh-huh.
You don't think I'm going to tell you that. I think it's really a religious story, to tell you the truth.
Hmm. The religion of what? The religion of money?
No, I think that this character now was very much more a nun-like character than you can realize on the surface from reading this story. And I think that it's almost a medieval story. You could look at it one way that he was, you know, like a faithful knight.
Courtly love.
Well, something courtly about his devotion to her. He's getting condemned by the black community at the same time she's getting condemned by the white community. So you have to read that. And then the impact on this little sex-oriented drinking crowd that she's always run around with is just a complete puzzle because they don't know what to do with her. You know, one falls in love with her and the other goes, the narrator goes off on a weekend with one of her longtime friends and somebody else takes over the partying of the crowd. They just all fall apart.
Well, one of the characters says about Nell, she thinks she can live her own life. She thinks she can make her own choices, something like that.
Yeah, that's one of their means of trying to explain her.
Is this a feminist tract? Is it a feminist expression, therefore, Elizabeth
Spencer? No, I'm not much into that. But if you have a real story, you ask me all these questions, if you have a real story, you can read things into it that weren't uppermost in my mind, but because it's about living people, it's like looking at life. And you can say, well, this is in this story, just as you could say, well, this is in life.
Mm-hmm.
So that up to you what you find in it, in a way.
Elizabeth Spencer, let's come back to some of the stories here in Jack of Diamonds. I'm thinking of one called Jean-Pierre, a young woman. Is this Callie? Marries a French-Canadian. Rather unexpectedly, she meets him, and it's as though, you know, you're reading along, and bingo, all of a sudden these two are married, and you think, well, okay, let's see where it goes. Mm-hmm. And then he exits from her life.
Mm-hmm.
You made me think, as I read that story, of a Hawthorne tale called Wakefield, about a man who just leaves his wife and moves a couple of blocks away. Now, as fanciful as that may sound, stays there for 20 years. Jean-Pierre doesn't quite carry it to that that extent. Am I supposed to believe this, that somebody just walks out of the wife's life and then comes back?
Well, if you didn't believe it, I failed. Did you?
What were you after there?
That story is laid in Quebec province in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just what teased me about that story and made me want to write it was later on, the French-Canadian population politically became very powerful and assertive. There was a lot of submerged social envy and sense of suppression amongst the French in the 60s, and that was beginning to surface in the 60s when we were living there.
Is that what happens with Jean-Pierre? We have a political parable as much as one of love?
It's an examination of, it's supposed to be, of the French-Canadian psyche reacting against the English, snobbishness, lack of knowledge of their community. Jean-Pierre himself was always afraid of the English put down, that they would criticize him. And she to me is rather heroic because one reviewer compared her to the faithful Griselda and another to Penelope, but whatever, she's just a kid almost. Mm-hmm. And they had this powerful sexual attraction. That's what the core of the story is. And that his act of marrying her was rather more of a protection than one might expect of him.
Protecting whom?
Her.
And not himself. Not himself, not being absorbed into that English society that he's fearful of at the same time he's drawn to it.
Mm-hmm. But they were into this affair, this rather passionate affair, and he married her, and that, to me, was creditable. But then he got frightened, and what frightened him, I don't know, but it's suggested throughout the story that it was some kind of weakness in his own business arrangements, and, mm-hmm. and that he had to shore up support for himself elsewhere, but he was afraid to tell her that because, for one thing, the French Canadians are rather mysterious and inclined to be clannish and talk about their deeper problems of this sort among themselves. He was afraid of her betraying him to that community he was frightened of.
Were you...
But the weight of the story falls on her,
right,
because she's tried to the limit. His money doesn't hold out. Yeah. She can't get any word from him, and, you know, she almost becomes attached to another man, but she doesn't.
Elizabeth Spencer, do you think of yourself still as a Southern writer? You've lived in Europe. You write in Jack of Diamonds, this collection of short stories about characters who live in Canada. You still sound like a Southerner. Do you still think of yourself as a Southerner?
Oh, yes. I'll always be a Southerner no matter where I live. Mm-hmm. I think it's a bit a test of a culture that you don't lose it. I mean, you would transport a French woman to, say, many, many years of living in where? California, but she'd still be a French woman.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a Southern woman particularly is always, I suppose Southern men are the same. I was too, by lineage, birth, everything, too bred as a Southerner ever to lose it now. Any more than my accent. They used to ask me in Montreal, where we lived for years, how I kept my accent. I said I never found any, tried to lose it, but I never tried to keep it either. It just is part of the my being. So I don't want to lose it. Goodness, I don't think it's anything to want to lose. It's something to be proud to keep.
Elizabeth Spencer is the author of Jack of Diamonds, a collection of short stories published last fall by Viking Penguin. Elizabeth Spencer's new play, For Lease or Sale, premieres next week at the Playmakers Repertory Theater in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a conversation about William Gilmore Sims, the 19th century Southern American writer. My guest is Marianne Wimsatt of Southwest Texas State University.
It's a difficult thing to estimate, but probably he, in total, produced over 100 volumes. We have around 80 of those that we know are from his hands that have been collected that were published during his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Material exists in periodicals to constitute about 20, maybe 30 volumes more, a lot of literary criticism and things of that sort. In
so it's
addition,
more than 100 altogether.
It's more than 100. He's the most voluminous writer I know of, and that includes Anthony Trollope.
Uh-huh.
The more I work with Sims, the more amazed I am at how much he wrote. He wrote all the time. He wrote over 1,500 letters, for example.
All right. Well, now, apart from his productivity, let's locate William Gilmore
right.
Sims. Why is it important that we understand him as a Southern writer, Marianne Wimsatt?
He was archetypally Southern in his sense of place, his sense of time and history, his awareness of social classes, his interest in concrete particular details that he worked into his writing, and to some extent in his interest in textual experimentation. This, of course, was not as widespread in his century as it has been in ours, but nevertheless you see Sims doing that, and that's one of the several hallmarks of Southern writing.
Mm-hmm.
From the, well, early 19th century on. But I would say, apart from that, and that describes what he did in his writing, he knew the areas of the South that 20th century scholars have identified and studied as southern subregions, the Lowcountry or Tidewater region, the Piedmont and Appalachian region, and of course the Gulf or Lower South, the Deep South as it's called. And he wrote books set in these areas.
Was William Gilmore Sims a defender of the South as well as a portrayer of the
yes,
South? Explain that to
me. He very much defended the South. In fact, you can see his fiction both as a partly unconscious, partly conscious defense of the South. I think all of it is loving and loyal to the South as he moves along in his career. And of course, as the sectional crisis intensified, he becomes more overtly defensive. And some of the passages in his work that have offended later readers come from the late 40s, particularly in the 1850s, when he becomes just blatantly defensive of Southern social institutions.
Let's just put a blunt question here on the table, Marianne Wimsatt. Was this man a racist? When we talk about him being a defender of the South, what kind of declarations, qualifications do you need to make there?
Wayne, he was a racist in the way that most Southerners of his time and class were racists. He believed in the South as a distinctive civilization. He thought that slavery was ordained by God, as many people, perhaps most educated people of his time, did. He, like other people, looked to the Bible to defend it. He becomes more overtly racist as the Civil War approaches. And after the war, when there were problems with black uprisings in South Carolina, he's more overtly racist.
What about the fact, Marianne Wimsatt, that William Gilmore Sims wrote sympathetically about Indians in the South? You wouldn't call him a racist from that standpoint, and yet with respect to black people, you would. A contradiction there?
To some extent, a contradiction. Of course, by the time he wrote about Indians, the Indian removal had already taken place.
So he could afford to, right.
I don't like to sound cynical about this. I think he felt keenly for the plight of the Indian, the Yemassee, mm-hmm. which is still his best-known book, and though not his best one, in certain ways his most moving one. The Yemassee shows his grief about how the Indians had been handled by the white settlers. But, of course, the Indians were in the Deep South by that time. They had either been exterminated or removed, so that he could afford to be elegiac and romantic about them. Again, I think his attitude toward Indians, as I see Sims, one always has to look at the context out of which he is writing.
Uh-huh.
In his long fiction and in his poetry, he's elegiac. He resembles writers of his time, Cooper, Robert Montgomery Byrd, Northern writers who wrote about the Indian. When he describes Indians whom he had seen in Charleston or in Mobile, Alabama, where he visited in the 1830s, he is more realistic, somewhat less flattering. It depends on whether he's viewing them through the lens of history and within the context of his genre, poetry or long fiction, or whether he's describing them in letters or short fiction.
How would you compare William Gilmore Sims, for example, to a writer like Mark Twain, in whom we have portraits of race and racial situations,
right.
yet we look at Mark Twain and we say, well, essentially here we are not dealing with a racist writer. We have a writer who
right.
presents situations about race and is making fun of it or condemning it. Is that what goes on in Sims? I take it that there really is not much of a comparison between the two.
I would say not. Interestingly, Twain is one of the writers he is thought to have influenced in his backwoods humor. There are some strikingly similar passages in Paddy McGann and Huck Finn, the raft passage in Paddy McGann, and some passages describing the sky that seem remarkably similar to Twain. But no, I would say unlike Twain. Of course, here again, Twain was only partly a Southerner. He was
right.
born in Missouri. He was part of a Midwestern Southern culture that made
yeah.
him something of an outsider at the same time that he was something perhaps of an insider. Sims was much more of an insider.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was writing many years earlier.
Let's talk for a couple of minutes, Marianne Wimsatt, about William Gilmore Sims's literary theories. I'm not sure that he would use a high-flown term like that, if it is indeed a high-flown term. The word that we're interested in here is the romance.
Right.
What does Sims do with that? Does that amount to a formula in his writing? What?
It is a formula insofar as it was a formula for all the writers of his time who were trying to reach the mass market that was developing as the result of the expansion of the reading public. He used ideas, he formulated ideas about romance that were a little in advance of Hawthorne's. What I started to say is that his notions of romance are notions that modern critics see are fundamental to the genre. And this is an important part of the work I've done on Sams. I've studied how he was able to fit his experience and knowledge of the southern subregions into the literary formulas of romance.
Mm-hmm.
Let
me stop you on that point, Marianne Winstead. How do we understand that word today when we talk about romance, when the literary critics use that term? We're not talking about heartthrobs and bodice rippers.
Right. No,
No. What, in fact, are we talking about?
The most persuasive literary theorists, Northrop Frye, Robert Scholes and Robert Kellogg, Gillian Beer in England, others, in America, talk about romance as a surprisingly enduring prose form, of course, poetry too, but in our time, chiefly a prose form, that is rooted in conflict and therefore has a dialectic or a two-sided structure showing forces in conflict, ideals and anti-ideals. In Sims's work, the ideals are usually Southern aristocrats or upper middle class people who are defending the South against various sorts of outside threats, Indians, Britons, the North, and Sims' light fiction, some of his fiction. Romance has this kind of framework, the dialectic structure, the ideals. It generally is set in a pastoral rather than an urban setting, and in happy romance that is sometimes called providential or Hegelian.
Uh-huh.
The endings, of course, come out in the ideal characters triumph. The happy endings that are so characteristic of romance really vindicate the triumph of the ideals over the forces threatening them.
In the case of William Gilmore Sims, Merriam Winsap, are we talking here about the formula of romance as something that that Sims, what, if not originated, helped to develop, or are we talking about the demands of the audience? That is to say, a writer who comes along and says, I want to give people what they want, give them happy endings and pastoral settings and all of that.
Wayne, I don't think the two can be separated. One of the most interesting parts of my study of Sims has been the way in which romance since the 18th century has become an increasingly popular or so-called bourgeois form that does speak directly to an audience.
Uh-huh.
Presumably it comes out of primal psychological patterns.
So it's not dead. We still have
it's not dead. Mm-hmm. One of the things Hugh Holman liked to say was that a study of historical romance needs to be done that explains why it was such a revered form in Sims's time and why it has slipped so far from critical favor in ours. No, it's by no means dead, and Sims, I think, was excellent in producing it.
Marianne Winsett, we've talked about William Gilmore Sims and his theories of romance. What about humor, satire, realism in his writing?
These are enormously important elements. Again, Hugh Holman was very interested in the realism. I've been extremely interested in the satire and the backwoods humor. Those are the two things I have worked on in particular within the framework of romance. That framework, with its conventionalized format, necessarily conventionalized for his audience, has obscured, I think, the fact that he was graphically realistic about war, particularly the Revolutionary War, which was his main subject in the Lowcountry fiction. He was highly satiric as he matured in the 40s, particularly in the 50s, of the pretensions that he saw in aristocratic Southern society, particularly as it centered in Charleston and to some extent on the plantations. He was perhaps at his best in humor in sketching frontier or backwoods type squatters, tall tale tellers. Two of his best works are tall tales set near the end of his life that derive from his travels in the mountain south.
Would we laugh at his humor today, Marianne?
Oh, yes. Winsett? When I have read papers dealing with the backwoods humor and with his social satire, I've gotten belly laughs from the audience.
So it's timeless. It is not necessarily...
It is.
He's located in the south, but transcends it.
Oh, the humor, yes. His humor is what is perhaps the best angle of his fiction, the best aspect of it.
The critics have accused him of being either a romantic or using the formula of romance or a realist or
they
untangle
have not
that
been
knot
able
for me.
To decide about that because he used romance formulas for his framework, his main plot. He's been called a romancer, and he is a romancer in
that
way.
But into that he injects.
But into that, the thing, as I told you, that attracted me so much about him when I started reading him was that he had these bright, sprightly, realistic episodes. He had wonderful satiric passages.
Uh-huh.
He's a much better writer of sharp sentences than he's been given credit for. He has excellent, just uproarious, backwoods humor of the tall tale sort. Those have been overlooked, I think, partly because people haven't read Sims enough, partly because they haven't been looking for it mm-hmm. when they read it.
Just a footnote here to our conversation on William Gilmore Sims, Marianne Wim said. How much of his stuff is available today?
A good bit of it, Wayne, is in print now. The Revolutionary War romances were brought out in the bicentennial year, so all of those are in print. All of the border romances, which are set in the lower South, the Gulf South, are in print, I think, with AMS. The Centennial Sims textual edition at the University of South Carolina got a lot of his short fiction into print and his last long novel, Voltmeyer. His poetry is more or less out of print, and that's something that's beginning to be studied in some detail now. I myself grew interested in it as an offshoot to the fiction because it relates to the fiction in certain important ways. But a good bit of his work is in print. It can be read.
Marianne Wimsatt teaches at Southwest Texas State University. Marianne Wimsatt is the author of The Major Fiction of William Gilmore Sims, published by Louisiana State University Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 433. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about the aims and methods of American education. My guests will include scholars from the Institute for Philosophical Research, Duke University, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor seminars on two topics, literature and its audiences, and the concept of republicanism. These enrichment programs are for high school teachers of literature and history. For an application, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 1989. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Mid-January marks an anniversary for the ratification of the Treaty of Paris, by which the Continental Congress officially ended the American Revolution in 1784. The elder statesman of the Revolution, Benjamin Franklin, was born in mid-January 1706. Nearly 226 years later marked the birth of another American statesman. Martin Luther King, Jr. was born in mid-January 1929. And Edgar Allan Poe, the author of The Raven, and Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general, have birthdays in mid-January. Poe in 1809, Lee in 1807. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.